another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we're wondering why the hell didn't Shelby shoot in association with OldFootballShirts.com? Well, it didn't all go according to plan, as we got our equaliser in first against Newcastle last Saturday. Surely the script said that we lose 1-0 against a side that hasn't won all season. It was a frustrating afternoon as we had to settle for a point, but it was always nice to see Lewis Dunk keep another clean sheet as he went between the sticks following Rob Sanchez's late red card. Yet another international break deprives us of an opportunity to add to our points total this weekend, but Albion's women's team are in action as they face Leicester at the Amex on Sunday. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we're delighted to welcome a woman whose rise up the sports presenting round has been quite a delight to watch, frankly. It's been amazing. Welcome to Jules Breach.
Hello, guys. How are you? Thanks for having me. It's been a while, hasn't it?
Firstly, can I just say, Jules, happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. I feel like I'm dragging this one out now. I've been celebrating it for a while, but yeah, thank you. Another year older, not wiser, but another year older.
Well, as you'll probably know, the Albion never win on your birthday. Bearing in mind your birthday is a day after mine. I know exactly how it goes. We never, ever win on my birthday, ever. It's just ridiculous.
Oh, stop whining. Stop whining. I just want to point out that what we're talking about here, when we say Jules' meteoric rise, is when the stadium opened and Latest TV decided to stick their oar in and take in a couple of rooms in the East Stand, Bill Smith invited us onto their show, of which they've had several Albion shows. And the presenter, Jules Breach, sorry to say that we hadn't heard of her before, but that was our first time together. And we are talking 10 years ago, Julie.
I know. Oh my God, you call me Julie. Yeah, only my mum calls me Julianne. But yeah, it's crazy really, thinking back to that. And actually when the Amex first opened, even prior to doing the stuff for Latest TV, I was hostessing in the Overline Lounge, showing people to their tables and hospitality. And I'd used to hang around after the shift was done so I could watch the games. Most of the other girls would all shoot off straight home as soon as the shift was done, which was at kickoff. And I'd always be like, I'm just gonna stay here and watch from over here. So I'd be a bit sneaky and stick around and watch the games. So yeah, it's been a weird few years, I think. I didn't expect to be where I am now. When I think back to 10 years ago when I first started working as a broadcaster. So I feel extremely lucky.
So was that stint at Latest TV your first foray into broadcasting?
No, my first job as a presenter was actually working on a shopping channel. Don't laugh.
No, selling what?
Oh, selling what? Everything. Absolutely everything, you name it, I sold it, from handbags to phones to bedding, mattresses, signed Wayne Rooney football shirts, literally you name it, I've sold it. So that was my first ever job as a presenter, which I got straight out of uni after I graduated from Sussex. And I was there for, I think, 3 years, which was, at the time, I thought, I mean, this is amazing. Like, I've straight out of uni got a job as a presenter, which is what I really wanted to do. But obviously, I didn't have a dream of becoming a shopping TV presenter. And maybe, I don't know, AD's got his hands up. He might want to.
A lot of people started doing that as well. But weren't you doing some stuff? I can't remember exactly who it was for, but wasn't it Sky Casino or something like that you were doing some stuff for as well?
Yeah, Sky Poker. So when I was at the shopping channel, I started just talking to other people who I worked with there about the fact that I really wanted to work in sport. And, you know, everyone naturally is like, well, why don't you like write to Sky? And so I did. And there weren't really any opportunities in the sports side of things, but there was on their poker channel. So yeah, I worked for Sky Poker for about, I think it was only about a year and a half, because unfortunately the channel then went under. Shock, I turn up and then it goes under. But it was nothing to do with me. I didn't swear, don't worry. That was very short-lived, but I got a bit of a taste for that, I guess, that type of broadcast, where it's obviously completely different to a shopping channel, and knew that I wanted to work in sport and specifically football. And yeah, after that, I basically just thought, well, what am I going to do? I've lost my job at Sky. I wasn't working for the shopping channel anymore. I decided to come away from there. And so I was just kind of went back to basics with it all and thought, you know what, I'm going to go back and study again. So I went back to Sussex and did my NCTJ, got my official journalism qualification. So I spent a year doing that. And I was doing that all around the time that I worked at Juice. So I wrote to Juice because I'd worked for Southern FM when I was at uni, just kind of work experience sort of stuff. And off the back of that, knew a few people at Juice, wrote to Juice, went in there and did some work experience for them. And eventually the sports show presenter went traveling. And so there was an opportunity to cover him. So I covered the sports show, and that was really my... That was my first real sports job. Yeah.
That was Ben, wasn't it? Was it Ben?
It was Ben, yeah. So yeah. Ben went off traveling for a few months and I'd gone in and basically shadowed Ben for a couple of months and helped him with some editing and some production stuff. And that sort of taught me how he did the show, and I saw how he ran the radio desk. And because you have to do everything yourself in local radio. Yeah. You don't have a producer to press all the buttons for you. So, so Ben sort of taught me how to run everything. And then when he went away, I covered him. And unfortunately for him, he never got his job back. Bless him. But it was an opportunity that I obviously took. And when Juice offered it to me, I obviously couldn't say no. So that was amazing. And that was really my first chance to cover live football. It was great.
Were you, I mean, we're going to come back on track in a minute, but were you surprised with the fact that Juice isn't actually around anymore? And it's pretty much a demise of local radio stations, particularly within Brighton, that we've got Reverb and Radio Sussex and a couple of other ones which are not really scratching the surface. But the majority, like we have Sun, we have Heart, all based in the city, then obviously Juice as well. And now there's not a lot.
Yeah, it's sad, but I kind of saw that was the way it was kind of going to go because of when I was at Southern FM, and we were Southern FM for about, I think, 2 years when I worked there, my first couple of years of uni, and then Global bought it and it became Heart. And so I saw that transition there and sort of knew a little bit of the background of how the radio industry worked because of my time there. So it didn't really surprise me, unfortunately, when it happened with Juice. And I'd already left by that point. But it's really sad for, you know, a lot of those guys and girls who work there are all my friends and lost jobs and stuff. So yeah, it is sad, but unfortunately media changes, doesn't it? And we're seeing that more now, not just with, you know, radio, but with TV as well.
Well, it does. There's this kind of formulaic aspect to it, but I think what also didn't help, what didn't help local radio certainly, was when Ofcom changed the rules about what the obligations were to produce local content. Now, when you've got, for instance, you're talking about Southern being taken over by Global, and you've got Bauer Media, and you've got all the various, and you've got the Absolute Group as well, and all the other groups that take over local or commercial radio. So I think there's, I mean, I'm telling our listeners rather than telling stuff that you already know, Jules, that there's public service broadcasting, which is basically the BBC to you and me. You've got commercial broadcasting on radio, which came in 1973. But you also have what we are beholden to, which is community radio. And that's a different thing again. We can't accept advertising. We can't accept sponsorship and donations and grants, but we can't accept advertising. So we're not a commercial radio station in that sense. So we're kind of outside that. The Ofcom change of rules from about 4 or 5 years ago that said commercial radio stations, local commercial radio stations, do not need to put in more than, and it was something ridiculous, like 7 hours a week local content. It wasn't 7 hours a day, it was 7 hours a week. And for me, that was the government trying to sound the death knell for local, commercial, but fairly independent radio stations. And I think that's where Juice was going to get hit hardest. Southern had already gone anyway, because the rest of it was content being bought in from that group of companies' head office, whether it was at Euston Square or whether it was at, you know, wherever that company was. So this is where, thankfully, and this is where you and I come in, AD, is that Reverb, because it's a community radio station, we had this unofficial kind of motto. We say what we want, we play what we want, because so long as we actually stayed within the realms of decency, we could do that. And it, we had to prove to ourselves, we have to prove to Ofcom, that we actually do offer local content.
But do you decide what the realms of decency are? Because that's slightly worrying, Al.
It's very worrying for me. Although that's well, I did once play.
We still have to sit with inside Ofcom's rules. I mean, Ada, you've seen the list that comes out every year, don't you, from Reverb?
Oh, yes, brilliant. The, it's absolutely brilliant. The, I love it.
Yeah, some of the profanities are so soft, you know, that we wouldn't be allowed to actually mention the name, not for context, of the president, the life president of Brighton and Hove Albion, because his Christian name is on the banned list.
Oh, you so mean Richard Knight?
In context. Sorry?
You mean Richard Knight?
Harry Richard Knight, absolutely.
That's the one, yeah.
You know, those are the things. So, I mean, obviously, I'm telling you things that you two already know. But yeah, this is where the writing was put on the wall. And I find that a tragic shame. This is where the likes of Reverb can step up. But there is still a space for Southern FM, for Juice FM. Mm. But the government decided otherwise. And it's the likes of yourself. Yeah. Now, you've actually managed to have that experience at local radio in order to springboard yourself into doing what you're doing. And what I fear, and I'd like your opinion on this, is do you think that the rug has been pulled from the next generation after you, Jules?
Not necessarily, because I think that the media just changes, Al, doesn't it? You know, like when I was first starting out, there wasn't things like YouTube channels. I mean, there was, but it wasn't really a big thing, if you know what I mean. So I think it changes naturally. And, you know, like now there is, you know, social media is so much bigger than it was 15 years ago when I first started getting into the industry. And you can use that as a tool so much more smartly than you could back then. And likewise, like I said, YouTube channels are a great place to start. I get so many people that it's really lovely, actually, that write to me and, you know, ask how I got into the industry and what would you advise them to do. And there's still, even though, of course, local radio is different now and there aren't as many potential opportunities as there might have been before, there are still some local radio stations that exist and there are local channels and there are places you can get experience now. So it's certainly different, that would be right, but I don't think it necessarily means there aren't opportunities out there.
Okay, well let's just like go back a little bit. Let's have a little think to ourselves about like sports presenters who support Brighton that started off on local radio. I mean, what who swings them? Oh yeah, Des Lynam. So I mean, so you're following in great footsteps there. And
Annie Nightingale.
Yeah, but she's not a sports presenter, is she?
Yeah, but she's an Albion fan who made it.
She is an Albion fan who has started on local radio. I will give her that, absolutely. But she's no Des in this particular result, who went on. So, I mean, obviously, I mean, you see that and that there's great shoes to follow in. So when you look at that, I mean, obviously, your progression has been massive. So, I mean, how far can you go? I mean, I see there's a vacancy on Sky on Soccer Saturday coming up.
I'm not going to go work for my rival show, am I? No, thank you. I'm pretty happy at BT. And you know what? I think we're all really proud of what we've done with BT Sports Score, because when the show started 6 years ago, which was when I first got the job at BT, you know, all anyone really knew on a Saturday at 3 o'clock was Soccer Saturday, Jeff and the Boys. And that's an institution. Like, I've grown up watching that show when I've not been at games or not been working at the Amex on Saturdays. So look, there was no way we were ever gonna try and compete with what Jeff and the Boys do. We just had to do something slightly different. But aside from Soccer Saturday and then BBC's version of Final Score, no one else had really done it on TV. So it was quite a big risk for BT to try something completely new and have two presenters and have a female presenter on that as well, which hadn't really been done before. And apart from, you know, when Ailey Barber covers on Final Score, or if like now they have Kelly Summers who does their Football League updates, but Soccer Saturday have never had a female co-host or any female host. So yeah, so I think, you know, we're really proud of where the show has gone in the last 6 years, and it's changed a lot, even from my first show. When I was first hired for it, I don't think they really knew what they wanted my role to be. And what it is today is very much what it is because of how I've molded it, which has been pretty awesome for me, to be honest. And they've been really great with allowing me to make that role whatever I kind of want it to be. Because I started off as, you know, the odd social media segment and then the odd football league update. And then I think they realized, actually, we could get you involved a bit more. And that's only happened really through more experience and just gaining a bit more confidence with it and just getting a bit more involved. And now the way it works, I'm like a co-host on the show, and it's very much double-headed with the two of us, me and Daryl Curry, which was obviously another change because we started with Mark Pugach. So yeah, it's evolved a lot, and we have so much fun. So I don't have any plans of going to work for Soccer Saturday, trust me.
You know what you've just said there, Jules? And the fact that, you know, you're a female, and we don't, you know, intend to be tokenistic here, but we are aware of the fact that, you know, the female sports journalists and female sports presenters are now becoming the norm. And if you're talking about stuff that happened a few years ago, are you aware of the position you hold and therefore the responsibility possibly that you hold, not just for female presenters now, but for female presenters coming through? Does it actually sort of like register with you that actually you are possibly opening doors for other female presenters?
When I first started, I didn't even think about that. No, I mean, it never even crossed my mind, because I was just like, oh my God, I've got my dream job. How have I got this? Like, this is incredible. But the longer you work in the industry and the more you speak to other females that have, you know, been there and done it before, and you talk to people who are then also starting out and, you know, all the different levels of their career, you get to realize that actually, yes, it is now being seen as, well, there's a lot more of us, there's a lot more females that work in sport now, and specifically in football, but that wasn't always the way. Even when I think about myself growing up and the broadcasters I looked up to, they were pretty much, well, apart from Sue Barker, who was the only female sports broadcaster who I genuinely looked at and thought, I want to be like Sue. Like, yeah. She's just amazing to me, and she's still, you know, my favorite female sports broadcaster. I just love her. But other than that, when I watch football matches, when you watch live football, it was always, for me, it was always men hosting those games. And that's ultimately what I would love to end up doing, is just host more live football matches. And, you know, that has never really been a place where females have been dominant. But now that we're seeing it more and I'm part of that, it does feel kind of weird, but it's a lovely feeling when younger girls, you know, get in touch with me on Instagram and on Twitter, and they just say, like, what you're doing is amazing and it's inspirational. And you just kind of think, oh, wow, because I never really had many people like that to look up to when I was growing up. So, yeah, it is a nice feeling.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. There wasn't that many, was it? I mean, there was Helen Rollison, who sadly left us. I mean, Claire Balding started who's absolutely a tour de force, isn't she, frankly? Yeah. She's amazing.
She's amazing. And I've worked with Claire. And you know what? I remember the first time I worked with her, because we worked on a lot of the women's football at BT Sport prior to us losing the rights last year. And Claire is incredible. Like, she is just amazing. And I just loved going to games with her. I would be the reporter and she would be the host. And I would just sit there and watch how she works. And you can learn so much from people like her who have just been there and done it for years and years and years. And I would just be in awe of how she speaks to people and how she does her notes. And it's little things like that, like knowing what kind of questions she asks and hearing certain questions that she does ask, you then think, oh my God, like, I've always been scared to ask a question like that because I'm worried that I might look stupid. And then you hear someone like her who has all the experience in the world and she's still asking those questions, and you're like, okay, cool. It's okay to not know everything. And it's okay to ask a question that you might feel a bit embarrassed to ask, because you're way better off going on air fully prepared and you know, knowing everything you need to know, than going on there just because you want to save face and not ask a question to the producer or the director about something. So, oh God, I've learned so much working with her, and I've been so lucky to work with people who I consider legends of broadcasting, like her and Mark Pugach. So yeah, I mean, she's phenomenal.
And James Richardson as well there. And I mean, we're going to talk about the FPL stuff in a bit, but I mean, James is a legend in broadcasting as well. I mean, we all grew up watching him do Football Italia, and I mean, it must be a pleasure to work with him as well.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately this year we're not working together anymore, but I just love him. He was just, I remember when they said to me, you're going to be doing the FPL show with James Richardson, I was like, really? I was like, I'm going to work with James every week, because as you say, like, that was just a TV show that everyone stuck on a Saturday. Even non-football fans, I think, watched that as well. You know what I mean? So, yeah, working with James is hilarious. He is such a character. Like, he's hilarious. Just some of the stuff he comes out with, and he is so different to anyone else I've ever worked with. Like, he's unique, and it's what makes him so good, because everything he does is off the cuff. And again, another brilliant person to work with.
Well, squaring that circle, isn't it? Where Aidy was talking about Brighton fans who made it through local radio. I mean, if we're going to talk Football Italia, then you have to talk Peter Brackley. Now, I don't know if you've got the chance to work with him, but I'd imagine that, again, someone that you can look to. And then it occurs to me, which goes on to my next question, do you have a hankering to actually do football or any sports commentary?
Oh God, no. No, 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 no. You know what? I think football commentary is probably the hardest thing to do in broadcasting, in sports broadcasting.
Go on.
The constant speech and having to continuously say things that make sense is really hard. Like, you know, as a host, as a presenter, my job is, it's not easy, but I get a break. You know, I ask a question, the pundit answers, and I have a bit of time there to think about what I want to say next, or I listen to what they say and I pick up on what they say, and then that formulates my next question or my next talking point. But with commentary, you have nowhere to hide. You've got no break apart from at halftime, and you can't make a mistake, because that's actually the bit that everyone's also listening to, you know, like, but when the match is on, everyone's listening. Whereas you might get some people that watch a bit of the broadcast prior, or you get a few people that watch it, but not everyone's watching that part. I think the commentator and the co-commentator have the hardest job, because they have to know every single player on that pitch inside out. They have to know when their birthday was, what they had for dinner last night, what size shoe they are. You know what I mean? And like, that is an insane amount of knowledge to keep up there and have ready to say, but also say it in like an entertaining way or like a concise way. And it blows my mind how good they are. Like, Peter Drury is my favorite commentator, and he is just the absolute best at it. He's unbelievable.
I mean, we're commentators, though, and I think Al will agree with me. It's not what you say, it's what you don't say. And it's like, tend to over-egg the cake somewhat these days.
AD, sorry, yeah. You've just done it there. You've Moulinex'd and you've mashed your metaphors. I think that's all three of us who could never do football commentary. Just
no.
But I mean, what I was going to say was that one person who didn't over-egg the cake was one we lost this week, which was Gerald Sinstad, Al.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is of people of a certain generation. I recall that Gerald, he worked for TBS back in the early 80s. Now, before that, this is in the days when ITV was a bunch of regional franchises. They were actually separate companies. So, you know, you'd watch The Big Match, which was a national programme with Brian Moore from London, but you'd have a commentator from a regional, from a given region. So the Northwest, Granada, that was Gerald Sinstad, and he'd be covering either Liverpool or Everton or Manchester United. It wasn't a case of everyone being on the television that in those days, like everyone was. There probably just weren't enough cameras, not enough technology, and they were too expensive. So they had a selection of games, and his way of doing things was always calm. I don't recall him ever getting excited. I do recall like a game when, I'll give you an example. It was it was in the early 80s. I think we were in the, we must have been in the top division because we were playing Spurs. I think it might have even been the season we went down. Spurs were 1-0 up. It was a drab game. The Goldstone was only half full. The pitch was like the moon. It wasn't a great game. And then the Albion equaliser with about 10 minutes to go. And you could hear the, well, not the exasperation, but the relief within his voice to say, that's what the game needed, a goal. You didn't have hyperbole, you didn't have screaming, you didn't have the co-commentator saying, oh, he wanted to make that ball his, this is all about so-and-so. He just actually said to everyone, I think everyone agreed with him, yeah, that game really needed a goal. The fact that the Albion went on to, you know, score again about 3 minutes later, I think left him relieved. And that was where you had this, you had this thing with the commentators from those days. Maybe we're biased, you and I, Adi, being these old smelly people who remember Gerald Sinstat and Martin Tyler and Hugh Johns and David Bobin and Dave Ralph Lanning Geller. And Tony Gubber, that they would actually just say sensible things in front of you. Not so much, even John Motson back in those days. Barry Davis was my favourite. They'd say just the sensible things rather than try and hype everything up. By the way, I've got my eye on you, Sam Matterface. Stop trying to hype everything. Just tell us what's going on.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what's going on. You're listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online, radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. This show, as ever, is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, and Phil has given us, well, I know what he's given me next week, but this one is, well, it's quite nice. So who wants to have a go at describing this one for me?
Julianne, would you like to have a go at describing this week's shirt?
You can call him Mum if you want to.
Can't believe you're calling me by my full name, Dad. Stop it. I don't recognise this shirt, I'm not gonna lie. It's not one I know.
Just try and describe it at the very least.
Yeah, so it is retro. I quite like it. I don't know it, but I like it. It's a retro looking shirt. It's got a collar, which I quite enjoy. It's blue. It's like, it's actually quite an Albion blue, I think. And it's got a white trim on the collar and a white trim down the sides of the shirt. And yeah, it's got a little bit of green in it as well, a bit of a green stripe around the collar.
Tell us about the sponsor. Do you recognise anything about that?
The sponsor is, am I allowed to say it?
Yeah.
Okay, good. The sponsor is Key Tech, which I haven't heard of. Should I have heard of that?
No.
Okay, good.
I never have.
Good.
This does have all the hallmarks of a kind of a non-league side. And to be fair, as the first time you've been on the show for the whole hour then, Jules, is that Phil does have a bit of a penchant for coming up with a second or third team shirt from about 30 years ago. And everything about this screams to me either a second or third team shirt from about 15, 20 years ago, and probably, just because he's been up there, from Scotland. He's actually hauled in all these shirts that he's got, and he said, right, I'm having this one, because it does look as though it's part of his collection. So I'm going to go for something from Scotland from about 15 years ago. But bum me on that, Adrian. Not a clue.
I actually think the badge, I'm really zooming in on it.
He's photoshopped it for one.
Oh, really? Is it not the real badge?
Yeah, no, it is the real badge, but he's messed about with it.
He's messed about with it.
Go on. What were you going to say, Jules?
I don't know. For some reason, it just strikes me as West Brom, but I don't know why.
It's not West Brom. I'll put you out of your misery. And you're wrong about the country, Al.
I always am.
He is actually English. Not too far out on the year. And he says, this is your shirt of the week. This is the 2002 to 2004 home shirt of Rochdale AFC.
Rochdale.
Okay. They go about with the imaginative nickname of The Dale. Rochdale play at the Spotland Stadium with a totally unnecessary capacity of 10,229. They were formed in 1907 and are currently managed by Robbie Stockdale, who, believe it or not, he played for England under-21s once and five times for the Scotland senior team. Rochdale haven't achieved much in their history, although they played 36 consecutive seasons in the Football League's bottom division from 1974 to 2010, which is pretty impressive, actually. No promotion or relegation for 36 years. That's rock and roll. Mm-hmm. It is a record, in fact. The fans of their local rivals, Oldham, used to refer to the bottom league as the Rochdale division. Rochdale's relegation and promotion history is also pretty dull. In their entire existence, they've been promoted three times in 1969, 2010 and 2014, and relegated four times, 1959, 1974, 2012 and 2021, last year. A few notable former players for you. Jimmy Greenough made his name with Stoke and Manchester United, but finished his career with the Dale in the 1983-84 season. And Ricky Lambert played 64 times for him between 2005 and 2006. Now, for your Albion links, they had a midfield player called Peter Ward. He made 84 appearances for Rochdale between 89 and 91. It's not that Peter Ward. The other one is the mono kidneyed. Oh, come on, Philip. Jimmy McNulty spent a short time with the Albion in 2009 until his injury. He's been with Rochdale since 2015, notching up 165 league appearances and counting. Chris O'Grady probably found his level with the Dale, playing 93 times, scoring 34 league goals between 2009 and 2011. There's also Liam Dickinson, Shamir Fellalan, Paddy McCourt and Paul McShane. But of course, there's one name we should all be talking about, and that is Glenn Murray. He made 54 appearances for Rochdale between 2006 and 2008. And he went on to make 259 appearances with the Albion, scoring 103 league goals. Now, come on, talk to me about Glenn Murray. You must have a bit of love for Glenn.
I've got a lot of love for Glenn. He's up there as one of my favourite Albion players of all time. Not only is he obviously just brilliant on the pitch and scored some amazing goals, but off the pitch, he is a proper decent human being as well. So I've been lucky enough to work with him a couple of times in the last couple of years. I think he came into BT prior to going to Forest, and obviously now retired. So he's in at the Premier League a fair bit at the moment. So yeah, he is just, he's great. And you know what? He's a really good pundit as well as player, because it's quite a tough gig that, you know, when you're so new out of the game, to be, you know, to be able to talk quite honestly about players who you've played with and players who are your friends and, you know, players you played up against and stuff. It's a real skill to be able to do it as nicely as he does. So yeah, I've got a lot of time for Glenn.
I was actually quite surprised that he went on to like work in the media. I mean, having watched him doing it now, he does come across as a complete natural. But I mean, when you look at the interviews he was doing with us when he was... But he came across as like kind of...
He's very aloof, very quiet, very shy.
He wasn't the greatest talker back then, but he's got a certain energy about the way he does things and a certain humour and a glint in his eye, which is always popular with viewers, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know what? He is shy. He isn't one of those that comes into the green room, you know, shouting and screaming and like that at all. But it's what he says and how he says it that's really interesting. And as I said, because he is so relevant, because he's so newly retired, they are the perfect guests to have, because you can have them on your shows and you can actually say to them, well, what was he like to play against? Was he a nightmare? You know, all of that kind of stuff. And he's always really honest about stuff, which is always good, because it's refreshing to hear, you know, like that. I think it's so hard to be a pundit that has been around for so long and constantly have new opinions, because people get bored, don't they, of the same thing being said over and over again. And I think what Glenn is doing is just quite refreshing, because it comes across genuine, comes across really honest. I think that's because that's what it is.
Yeah. Going back to the shirt of the week, there's a couple of things that I think that Phil has left out there, which I think are kind of important with Rochdale. One, he has left out the fact that we did send out our current Spanish international goalkeeper on loan to Rochdale.
This is very true.
Yeah.
And also Rochdale were involved in the second highest official match attendance for a Brighton home game.
Yeah. Oh.
And Hayden Roberts was there last season as well, though.
Was it? Okay. 34,766, 1972. Only been beaten once, admittedly 14 years earlier. But yeah, when you think of that, you think, oh, who's your biggest ever attendances against? Sorry, in second place is Rochdale. Go okay. figure.
Okay, well, okay. No, Jules, well, going back there, I mean, you said that Glenn is one of your favourite Albion players of all time. Who is your favourite Albion player of all time?
I'm going to say, before you answer this, there's two questions here. One, who's your favourite and who do you think is best?
Oh, they probably are the same person, Bobby Zamora.
Okay, yep.
I knew it was going to be Bobby.
Of course it's Bobby. Like, Bobby's like my generation of, like, when I really got into football and I started actually watching the games, you know, because when you're a kid, you watch football, but you don't really take it in. You don't. Well, I didn't anyway. I was just sort of watched it with my dad and was like, oh, that's nice. Yeah. but when I started getting into football properly and going to games and stuff, yeah, Bobby Zamora was the man. So I'll never forget, actually, when I was working as a hostess at Brighton, Bobby was there and he came up to the lounge and I was just like, I need to get a photo. I don't care if I'm working. Like, this is so unprofessional. But I was like, I'm just going to ask him for a photo. And I did. And I've still got that photo. And yeah, no, he's just, well, he's a legend, isn't he? I don't really need to say, you know, how important his goals have been over the years and what a top striker he is. And again, another top guy as well.
One thing that we actually normally do with people who are on this show for the first time, now I do appreciate you've had a quick 10 minutes here and there, but actually we're doing this kind of a little bit arse about facings. We're asking if you're a favourite Albion player. The first question we normally ask is, tell us about your first Albion experience. So if it's not giving too much away, tell us about your background and how you came to start following the Albion, your first game.
Yeah, well, if I'm honest, I don't remember my first game. I was probably too young to remember it. But I've been going to football for just years, ever since I was a kid, really. Just with my family, my cousin. My cousins who I lived with when I was growing up were all Albion supporters. And my dad is actually from the borough. So my dad's actually a Middlesbrough fan. But because he lived in Brighton for so long, he sort of also supports Brighton. I know that you're not meant to have two teams, but he does also support Brighton. And so, yeah, I just kind of grew up as a football fan because of my household. But my first real sort of like memories of being a football fan are more just England stuff, to be honest. Like, I remember watching England games with my dad and with all my family around. And that's when I really got into football. And then it was probably a bit later on in life when I started actually taking football more seriously, when I was sort of in my late teens, really, going into college and going into university, where I started following like club football really seriously. So yeah, but like a lot of my love of football also comes from non-league. Like, I've always gone to, like, when I was living in Brighton, I used to go to Lewis most weekends and watch their games. And just, you know, it's just, I've just always been a football fan as such. But can I remember my very first Brighton game? No, I actually can't, which is really bad. I can remember the last one I went to.
Yeah, okay. You must remember where it was.
Oh, at the Withdean.
Right.
Yeah, I never went to the Goldstone. Come on, I'm younger than that.
hang on a minute.
Okay, I mean, there's worse places to go than the Pansiero to watch football, isn't there? The question is, if your dad's a smoggy, Palmo, yes or no?
Oh yeah, hell yeah.
Anything. I guess for the benefit of the listener, can you just tell us what a Palmo is?
I'm not fussy when it comes to foods. Trust me. I'll eat anything. I mean, to be honest though, we've never, like, whenever I go up to Borough, it's not really about the Palmo. We always get fish and chips when we're up there. And my dad always says, you've got to get the scraps. And I never knew what that was. And I was like, what are the scraps? And it's a really big thing up north. You ask for scraps and it's all of the little bits of batter that yep. end up at the bottom of the fryer. And my dad said that when they were kids, like, they'd go to the chippy And they'd always say, like, can we have the scraps? And you get them for free. And it's just kind of become a bit of a tradition. So we always do that when we're up north.
Yeah, I know, you got so excited there, Al. Why are you so excited about scraps?
Because they're good.
No, I fully get that. Because my partner, Jules, is from, of all places, Grimsby. So when it comes to that, and she used to, first times I used to, when I first met her, she would say, oh, well, fish and chips down here, they're all right, but you don't get scraps. I knew exactly what it was she was talking about, but, and she's, nowadays, you can't ask for scraps and you're okay.
Yeah.
It's not a problem. But yeah, down here, you'd ask for scraps and you go, well, what is that? And yes, it's just the leftover bits from the basically the bottom of the fryer, isn't it?
Oh, so good. It's basically the fatty bit that everyone wants to eat. That's the crunchiest bit. It's great.
Didn't realise that was a tradition that went as far north as Middlesbrough, but I guess if there's all the fish trawlers that go into any of the northeastern ports, then yeah. But certainly yeah. Grimsby, yeah. I've been lectured on that on many occasions.
Okay, well, let's go a little bit further north now and to Newcastle, who came down to visit us last weekend. And as I said in the intro, there, I mean, we got our equaliser in first because, I mean, the script was, every time we put, I mean, I've followed the Albion for way too long to realise that every time we play someone where we're meant to win, we always lose 1-0. So we got our equaliser in first there, Jules.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a game of two incidents, really, wasn't it? There was our penalty and then there was our sending off. To be honest, as you say, it was one of those where I thought it would be so Albion to not win this game. But I also didn't think Newcastle would win. I didn't go into the game thinking they'll beat us. I was hoping they didn't appoint a new manager before the game because I thought, God, that could give them a bit of a boost. And thankfully they didn't, even though Eddie Howe was actually at the Amex. But yeah, look, I actually thought we played really well in the first half. I thought we played well and I thought we deserved to be in front. I did think it was a penalty. I thought it was clumsy of Kieran Clark to basically trip Trossard over in the box. So I don't have any complaints with that. And I think that if it was the other way around, we'd be annoyed that they got a soft penalty, but we'd also go, okay, well, he has made contact there. So it was a penalty. And I think that we deserve to be in front. And I think in the second half, we just, for some reason, dropped down a gear. I don't know why. I still think that we had opportunities to go 2-3-0 up and we just didn't really take them. But yeah, they got back into the game and we were then lucky in the end that Callum Wilson didn't manage to get through on goal and didn't manage to score because if Sanchez didn't bring him down, we'd lost that game. So yeah, a sending off, but he saved us a point basically.
But Al, we'll come back to that bit in a minute, Jules. But Al, I mean, you came out when I see you after the game, and I've never seen you that animated after a game, actually. And like, and everything about how half paced everything was. How
I thought it was pathetic. I actually thought the whole game was pathetic. Just varying grades of it. You know, you saw the team set up. Everyone for the first time is so excited about seeing Cucurella and Lamptey on the pitch at the same time. Now, admittedly, not playing as wing backs. I mean, there was times when Lamptey was the furthest forward player, and I have there. You could see, bearing in mind that Lamptey can have any left back on toast, with a bit of butter and marmalade thrown in, and yet Veltman just point blank refused to pass to him or play that ball over the top. You know, they played such a line, a very deep line, but they had the opportunity to play that, and any time he did play it. Or it was played to him, Lamptey unleashed hell. He unleashed carnage on the Newcastle defence. So you have this thing of the defenders being slow, slow. The forwards trying to look for space, they knew how to play it. And yet, for whatever reason, it was half-paced, it was unimaginative, it was unintelligent. We know how to break down poor sides like Newcastle. And at the moment, Newcastle United are a very, very poor side. Unbelievably, we made them look half reasonable in the second half. But for that first half, when, yes, we had our chances, the shooting boots disease seems to be spreading far and wide. Yeah. Looking at you, Adam Lallana. Sorry, you know, that was a sitter. And we cannot afford those sitters anymore. You know, it was, there was just no coherence. And then when it came to the second half, making, how anyone can make Newcastle look half decent by being so sloppy, by being so half-paced, and you felt that the equaliser was coming.
Jules, you did an article in the Brighton Indy recently on Mark Cucurella and his plus points, and of which there are many. But we actually probably saw why he's playing for Brighton and not someone higher up the tree with his efforts in front of goal, shall we say. I mean, he was... well, when you're shooting and it goes out for a throw-in, well, it nearly went out for a throw-in, when you're well-placed, and then you've got a header 6 yards out and you put it, like, 6 yards wide, it's a bit... it's comical, really.
What I think AD's saying here is, would you like to reevaluate your considerations of Mark Cucurella?
No, I wouldn't, actually, because I think that's something that he can obviously work on, and he's got a fantastic coach to be able to work on that. And I don't think he necessarily came to Brighton as the ready-made article, because not many players do. Like, at the end of the day, we're not going to sign players that can play, you know, right at the top of the game, because that's not where we are as a club. And I think that he has a lot of natural talent. And I think that what he does well is he can take players on. He's extremely skillful on the ball. He puts in some decent crosses. One of the things that I think that we haven't had that much of before is a player that can put in flat crosses into the box well. Because at the end of the day, when you look at the strikers that we have, they're not big strikers that are going to be target men that can, you know, win the ball in the air and score with their head. That's not going to be what Neil Mopay or Leandro Trossard are there for. You know, they're more players that want the ball to feet, that can, you know, get around a player and shoot. And I think that what Cucurella has is the ability to play in those passes, which I don't necessarily think we've had that well on the left-hand side before. Mm-hmm. So definitely, obviously I want to see him scoring goals, and that's something that he can improve on. But yeah, he definitely needs to work on it, because I think particularly the header was the one for me that I was like, oh, that was such a bad miss. But well, look, he's got a big head of hair. You don't know what that's like, AD. Come on.
Oh, 1-0 to
Bolton. I'll send you a photo later, Jules.
Welcome to the Albion Raw, Jules.
My hair used to be longer than his, I'll have you know. But,
the point you're making here about Cucurella and his swing of a shot was pretty horrific. I would say that about any professional footballer. I'd say this certainly a Premier League footballer, where you are expected, just as a Premier League player, to be of a given standard. And it's something we had a discussion, and this is what I love about being at the Amex, is that because the bars are open, you know, the post-mortem you have, the fact you're able to have a good natter about it afterwards, rather than just disappearing to the park, you can have, you actually have, and it used to be the case, you can watch the highlights, not showing the West Stand up, or certainly these days. But the notion was that we were discussing was how one-footed just about every single Albion player is, with the main exception of being the goalkeepers that we've had, who have to, because of sometimes the pressure they're under, have to, you know, be able to swing a good belted ball up the pitch. You saw it with Cucurella with his right foot swinger. You saw it each time Lamptey cut in. He had no confidence to take a left foot shot. The only other person probably who springs to mind who is the most two-footed is Solly March. We saw him score a really good goal with his right foot against Aston Villa. But even then, sometimes he has to keep cutting back on his left. It's fine, but I find it such a bizarre thing. And maybe there's a reason for it, because it is so rare that coaches aren't that worried about it. But I do find it a bizarre thing that there are not more players who can put in a good cross with both feet, can score, you know, and shoot with both feet. And it seems to be a rarity.
Salah.
the one person who springs to mind most of all, and certainly of anyone I've ever watched live, that could do that best was Zinedine Zidane. And if it has to take someone who's so far at the top of the game to be able to be noted to be a two-footed player,
I find that a bit past it now. I wouldn't sign him now, but maybe his gaffer. But
sorry, Jules, you wanted to say something there.
I mean, you mentioned goalkeepers. Who are good with both feet. I mean, Lewis Dunk. You know, two clean sheets from two appearances in goal. I mean, you know.
Sorry, can I have one more mini rant here, AD?
Go on.
Well, the thing is, you were mentioning about the sending off bit. Now it took an extra look because. Was it a case that Wilson decided to go flying, or was it the case that Sanchez did catch him? Now, with the VAR, you know, is enough there to catch him. But I think that the words of wisdom and basically those who understand science could say that Wilson could have carried on. And this is what concerns me, not necessarily about him, because he's done us a favour. But what he's done is the mindset is the first thing to do is go down and get your man sent off. Whereas the reality is he could have actually rounded the keeper, and bearing in mind it was after 90 minutes, rounded the keeper, zoomed in on goal, got the winner, because we were never going to get an equaliser. And yet his first consideration is, rather than try and stay on his feet and carry on, which looked like he could have done, was to go down. Mm. I would say, and I don't care what any Newcastle fans think, I would say that actually Callum Wilson somewhat greedily and somewhat stupidly cost his side 2 points and benefited us a point. By virtue of the fact that actually he could have stayed on his feet.
But can we just have a quick snigger at John Joe Shelby and his free kick, though? Because, I mean, you've got an outfield player in goal. You've got a free kick, like, 25 yards out. The wall wasn't that well organised.
I have never been so happy to see a player stand over a free kick than when John Joe Shelby stood there. I was like, oh, this is going to be fine. We'll be all right.
And ironically, what happened then after that, Lewis Dunk takes the goal kick. And the ball's up the other end for the last 4 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, don't get me wrong. Absolutely. Keep it away from Lewis Dunk as best you can. But you think, why can you do this the rest of the game?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Jules, we are running out of time. So I just want to ask you something else just quickly, which is obviously when you're doing your BT Sport Saturday stuff and you're in and amongst other amazing pundits and former players and stuff. What are they saying about Brighton? What's their opinion about us?
You know what? I'm so smug this year because I feel like I've won. Because last year, honestly, the amount of stick I was getting from everyone, just like, oh, well, like, what if you go down playing this nice football? Wouldn't you rather have Chris Hughton keep you up and, you know, play that defensive style again? And I'm like, no, I would rather us go down playing this football and knowing there's a plan in place and a project with the club. Because as fans, all you want to know is that your football club, when you look at how many clubs have fallen by the wayside and financial trouble clubs go in, how wonderful is it to be a Brighton fan at the moment where you can see the structure of this club, you can see the plan in place, the training facilities, the amount of input that the club are giving to the women's team, who are absolutely flying, by the way, like absolutely flying. And you just look at all of that and you think we are going in the right direction, and nothing is better as a football fan knowing that that is the case. So this year, I just feel so smug because everyone's coming up to me going, oh God, mustn't it be nice to be a Brighton fan this year? And I'm like, it was really nice being a Brighton fan last year, thank you very much. Yeah, it was a bit tense towards the back end of the season, but it's kind of what we like as football fans. There's got to be a bit of jeopardy in it. It's just nice that I already feel like when probably not going to be in a relegation battle this year. I'm not getting my hopes up too much that we're going to necessarily finish in the top half, but that's the aim now. The aim is to finish top half of the table. And if we do that, then what a season.
Does this include squealing twice live on air for the same goal?
Hey, that was a long time ago.
It's part of your CV, isn't it?
It is part of my CV. Thanks for that, Glenn Murray against Stoke. I don't think I'll ever live that one down. But yeah, look, it's hard. There's replay screens. You don't know what you're looking at half the time. Sometimes I'm like, is that live? Is that a replay? What is this? But yeah, well, thankfully, there's been a lot more goals to celebrate this season from Brighton. I know recently, you know, we're what, 6 without a win now in the league. We haven't won since September, but we have had a couple of tough fixtures in there. You know, we've had the Liverpool game, we've had the Man City game. And obviously we played Palace in that time where we got that point, which I was at that match at Selhurst Park, which was amazing. Saw you boys there. And look, it was, it's still been a good start to the season. We could do with just getting a win on the board next time out, but obviously that's now looking like quite a tough game, annoyingly.
New manager bounce.
Yeah, Stevie G's going to be in the dugout, and he's famously like one of my favourite players of all time, and I'm like dreading it now. But I feel like Villa Park is going to be bouncing, and we need to go there and just play our game. And I think that on the day, we're better than them.
Yeah, and just quickly, Jules, before we finish, obviously you cover a lot of Europa League stuff. What would it mean to see the Albion on one of those shows?
Oh my God, don't. That's what everyone keeps saying to me. They're like, now you work on the Europa League, Brighton are going to be there next year. And I'm like, I really hope so, because it's been really exciting for me. Like, you know, as a football fan and someone who does this job and just loves every day. And I honestly can't believe I get paid to do what I do sometimes. But it is just amazing working on like the best football rights. So to be able to work on European football for BT is an absolute joy. And I've been covering West Ham this year, which has been just brilliant because they've got such a good story this year. There's a real feel-good factor around them, and working with Carlton Cole and Joe Cole is just hilarious. They're such a good crack together. So what it would be mean to see Brighton there next year, it would be unbelievable. As I said, though, I'm not going to get my hopes up too high just yet.
You wouldn't. You might finish off, therefore, with one question. It's just something I wanted to touch on here. And I do apologise if you think I'm putting you in the middle of the spotlight here, but... So with all that stuff that you're talking about there and having such a great time with BT Sport and supporting the Albion and effectively flying the flag for the club at the TV station there. But like I say, as we were mentioned earlier, there is Jules Breach, female presenter. And this is obviously something which is going to become more and more the norm. But there you were. You know, all right, you followed Jackie Oatley and Claire Balding and Helen Rollison, but you're certainly the vanguard of that next generation. How does that feel for you going forward? Or is that something that you're actually just not going to give too much credence to?
Oh, no, I'm extremely proud of being part of this new generation of female broadcasters in a male-dominated world, because I think it's important for younger girls who want to work in the industry, whether that's on screen or behind the cameras or in the offices or wherever it might be. Working in sport was never really seen as a place where women would feel accepted. And I think that the reality of it is you can be accepted in this area. You can be, you can feel comfortable. And I think that as a woman who works in football, I can say quite confidently to other young girls that it is a place where you can be successful and that you can find your place. And it's important that women like me who have the opportunity to sort of be there and be representative of that, that we do a good job of it. So I do feel a responsibility. I do feel like it's important that I don't let anyone down and that I do a good job. And yeah, fingers crossed, I continue to get opportunities because I love what I do. And I hope I just continue to work on the best football for the best networks in the country. And that's really just what my aim is just to continue enjoying my job. And hopefully if that inspires some younger girls along the way, then that's just a bonus.
Excellent. And we echo those words there, Jules. And thank you so much for joining us here on the Albion Roar. And we'll be seeing you when you're fronting, taking over from Gary Lineker in the World Cup next time round. You have been listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online, radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I've been Aidy Packham. He's been Alan Wares. We'll see you again next week. Thanks for listening. Bye.